Welcome to season two of Irish Imperial Lives. I'm A.B. Philbin Bowman.
And I'm Kate O'Malley.
And if you haven't heard the series before, please don't worry. This is not one of those podcasts. You have to listen to every episode sequentially. Each one is a standalone episode. It'll tell the story of an individual Irish person as they navigate the world built by the British and other empires.
And what we're hoping to do by looking at one life is replicating what historians might call micro-history. We're looking at one specific life and sometimes one or two, and we're trying to draw out what that one life can tell us about the global world at the time.
We're also trying to build a more nuanced and accurate picture of Irish people's involvement in the empire. And we're going to meet several people this season who, in one sense, work loyally for the empire, but they also use the position they gain to advocate for things like Catholic emancipation or home rule. As I say, there's no homework. You don't have to have done any research for this. But if you did miss season one, quick recap. In a shocking development, we discovered that Irish history is not made up entirely of failed revolutions that didn't quite get off the ground. There are actually a whole bunch of Irish people who left our shores and ended up trying to navigate the world that was being forged by the British Empire and by other imperial forces, France, Russia, the Dutch, etc. And we're going to try and explore lots of those this season. We are stretching from the wilds of Canada to the expanse of Russia, the deserts of Sudan, the incredible expansion of the British in India. Have I left anywhere out, Kate?
No, I don't think so. But no doubt our listeners can tell us if you have.
Oh, South America. We get to South America for the first time this season. This is really an incredible geographic spread in just six lives. And I also have to say a massive thank you to the listeners who got in touch at irishimperiallives@rte.ie, because we got some fantastic suggestions, and about half of this season's episodes were inspired by those suggestions. So we will give a shout out to people as we go through.
And don't worry if we didn't get to you, because there were lots of other suggestions. We just didn't have capacity in six lives. It's so few, but we really hope to do more in the future.
I literally have an entire database of all of the suggestions we got sent in, trying to cross-reference people by religion, geography, gender, etc., where they were active, where they were born.
Keep them coming.
Trying to bring you, as I said, a wide variety of people active in South America, Canada, India.
But we're starting season two right here in Ireland at the very outset of the British Imperial Project, looking at a woman who has fascinated readers and historians for generations, but about whom very few documentary sources remain. A pirate, a chieftain, a trader, a diplomat.
It is, of course, Grace O'Malley, also known as Gráinne Whale.
And our guest today is historian Gillian Kenny, who is working on a major new biography of Grace O'Malley.
And we began by asking Gillian what we know about Grace O'Malley's early life.
We know very little about her, really. She's born sometime around 1530. So she is from a Gaelic-Irish family. Her father is the kind of chieftain of quite a small but quite influential lordship called Uil, which is coterminous with Murrisk, as you know it in Mayo today. And she would appear to be the only child of that marriage. Her mother was probably also an O'Malley. There was an older brother, but he appears to have not been capable of taking the chieftainship on. So he was Donal an Pipa, and he is there, but he's obviously, it's something stopping him from taking over leadership of the O'Malleys.
She got all the brains, I think.
So she's born and brought up in this small maritime lordship, quite an important part of a seafaring tradition along the west coast. It's very different to what you imagine it would be. It is not quiet. It is not what you see when you go to the west of Ireland today. Her father and lords like him along the west coast would have welcomed maritime traffic from all over Europe. They were selling licenses to fish. They were also charging people to go through their waters. You know, there's people there from Spain, from Portugal. There's Algerian pirates along the west coast. So it's very busy. She's growing up in a place where language skills would be needed. Mathematical skills would be needed. You're talking about trade. She would have learned, as it were, on the job.
It's sort of on the job shadowing your father. And we have to remember, if nothing else, the roads are terrible. Getting anywhere by sea is far faster. So it's in a way no surprise the Western Seaboard is hopping, because that's the easiest way to get to that whole part of the country.
Her education is to run a lordship with her husband. So she needs to know how to do that. So that's the focus that would have been on her. she probably got married quite young, probably in her teens, to Don't Love Laherty, who was lord of a neighbouring maritime lordship on the West Coast. So it makes sense. Makes absolute sense.
What do we know about their life? Do they have children? Are they fishing, trading, travelling to Spain? Paint us a picture of this period of her life.
Okay, so she had three children with Donal. And look, the stories told about her, many of them are more folklore than history. Okay, so when we talk about her marriage, for example, we'll talk about the idea that her husband was a very good warrior but not a great husband. Well, we don't really know where that's come from. That's one of the stories that's grown up about it.
So can we talk a little bit then about marriage at this time, the types of marriages?
Under Gaelic law, you were allowed to have approximately 10 types of marriage. Some of them are very loosely marriages. They're like a kind of a booty call. They're like a marriage for a night.
So sorry, were we like pioneering the 15 different kinds of relationships? Saying yeah, it's complicated marriage. And there's the, we're seeing each other, but not publicly, marriage. And the, wow, I'm impressed by Gaelic Ireland. It's reflecting the true complexity of human interaction.
Now, look, quite a lot of these different types of marriages are set up to benefit Gaelic chieftains.
Who could have
lots of different types of wives.
Oh, right, it's the men writing the rules again.
It's the men writing the rules.
Sorry, there was, I
sorry,
think,
Avey.
Was
no,
like, no, no, some
sorry,
Avey. Enlightened state of actually...
It's the men's. The men's are doing it again for themselves. Yeah.
So, please, Sean.
Yeah, but you could also have concubines under the Gaelic system as well, which are not like a full wife. So you'd have a wife of the same status as yourself. You could have a wife of a higher status than you or a lower status. And marriage in Gaelic culture is civil. It is not a religious act. The religious piece really only came in widespread post the mid 16th century. Most Irish people have never been in our history, have never been in a church and got married. Let's think about that for a second.
Yes.
Can we ask what classification of marriage they had?
They would have had the highest level of a marriage of equal status.
Okay.
So the man and the woman bring goods of equal value to it. Now, the really interesting thing in terms of women's history about Gaelic marriage is when you marry like this is women could retain control of what they brought to the marriage.
Okay.
So it's very different than the English system.
Okay.
So the English system, the woman comes in and she loses every single legal right that she has when she gets married. She has the legal right of a child under her husband. Okay. The Gaelic system, that didn't happen. Now, the Gaelic system, the woman was disenfranchised in different ways. But it's interesting for Gráinne because, of course, when you brought your dairy with you, the story is that she brought a couple of ships as part of her dairy.
That's a good dairy.
And she could manage them and the men on them. So they were loyal to her.
Well, the nice thing with ships is if you could take control of them
and
things don't work out, you're like, well, actually, I'm just going on my ships and just taking them where I want. You know, unlike a castle, say, which he can kind of occupy and surround with soldiers. You can't do that with a ship
you're
as easily.
You're off with a ship. So Gaelic dairies were normally movables because they would have been like cattle, sheep, things like that. And I've found instances where women's dairies consisted of actual soldiers. So they would bring a band of soldiers who are answerable to them. And there are these women take these soldiers and run rampant. There are women in Irish history who told their soldiers to do things and their husbands did not approve, but they did it anyway.
Wow. I mean, they're dowries I've not heard of before.
I think we should bring back soldier dowries.
I think my original comment about this sounds a bit more enlightened actually might stand up after all.
I think you could have your soldiers standing beside you as he tries to turn off the telly to something you don't like and you just look at him. The soldier just stares, put it back.
Yeah.
But the Hen's Castle story is an interesting one.
Can you just tell us the full story just for the benefit of people like myself who don't know this story?
Donal O'Flaherty was eventually killed in inter-clan warfare. One of the stories is he died while he was hunting.
Was that by the Joyces?
Yeah.
I'm interested in that because locally in Hetford, there's a lot of Joyces still knocking around. They own a lot of shops.
Sorry, Kate, as an O'Malley, are you looking for reparations here? Is that the whole purpose of this podcast?
I wasn't going to say that, AB, but now that you suggest it, it's quite entertaining to think that, you know, there's still a whole swathe of Joyces there and that they killed one of our own. Well, no, he wasn't. He was Donal an Cogadh, right?
So Donal O'Flaherty was killed off and he was killed by the Joyces. And then they set sail against her to take the castle. It was originally supposed to have been called Cox Castle because, you know, the man. It was in honour of him. He was very warlike and she defended it. So they, in honour of her, they renamed it from Cox Castle to Hen's Castle.
So after her first husband dies, we get into the phase of Gráinne's life where she's kind of breaking free from the gender constraints of the time. She becomes, I think, a de facto chieftain or pirate.
You say pirate, I say a lord imposing taxes on those who sail through her waters.
Yeah, fair enough. Look, if this was an Instagram story, she's going from trad wife to girl boss. I want to know, how does that work in the 1500s?
When her first marriage ended, right, she went back into her father's kingdom, her lordship rather, because under Gaelic law, you did have to go back.
Okay.
You had to be under the overlordship of a man at all times.
Okay.
Now, she went back to Uil, but she doesn't appear to have been under the overlordship of anyone. So there was that.
At this point, most of Europe is running on the system of primogeniture, right, which is where the king's eldest son inherits the throne. This causes chaos for Henry VIII, who can't produce a son, and for the Romanovs when they have children on the throne and invalids and so on. But in Ireland, we have the Tánaiste system, where the clan gets together before the chieftain dies and they all decide between themselves, who do we think is actually the best person for the job? Maybe it's the king's brother or his son or somebody else. Now, I'm wondering, could Gráinne have been chosen through that system?
So that's ideally the system. But in reality, there's a crossover between Gaelic and English legal traditions. What you begin to see across Gaelic lordships in the later medieval period into this period is they begin to adopt more or less primogeniture. So a lot of the time the Tánaiste would be the eldest son. That's just the way it begins to work. Because the people growing up then, the people living then, had influence and access to the different legal systems. So they were aware of how things ran. And it is difficult as well, because in the Gaelic system, it can give rise to problems. Because even if someone is elected Tánaiste, that won't stop anyone else
having a go.
Okay. So it can get a bit Game of Thrones.
So it's kind of loose.
It can be, but you do find some of the bigger ones, they are very clearly nominating older sons or a nephew, very clearly having the direct link that brings that stability.
And is it right then to say the thing with the O'Malleys is that they're not one of the bigger ones, that they kind of are fending for themselves a little bit? So maybe it's slightly different from their point of view.
Yeah, they're a smaller one. But under Gaelic law and tradition, a woman could not rule.
Yes.
So the fact that she did what she did as she got older is remarkable that she actually got to do that. So as she was being brought up, she would never have been considered. It's inconceivable to the Gaelic mind that a woman could rule.
And she never was called chieftain, just to clarify that.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
Which means she must have been a person of exceptional ability and leadership skills and all of the skills one needs to run a chieftainship, to command people at sea, command people in battle. She just must have had huge wisdom, charisma, judgment, etc.
There's loads of stories about her warlike demeanour.
And another personal interest factor fiction moment is the Howth Castle story.
So the story is she came to visit, she knocked in the Lord of Howth and there was nobody there. So there was no way of letting her in and giving her hospitality. So the key to the story is one of the great truths of Gaelic culture is that you always had to give hospitality to a guest. She was turned away and she was annoyed. So she saw the grandson of the Lord of Howth playing on a beach and she kidnapped him and took him to the west of Ireland.
Again, that's kind of that manic behaviour, isn't it?
It's anti-woman.
What kind of mother would do that to a
who would do
someone
that?
Else's child?
Yeah. Think about the times it's happening in, right? This is the period when in the rest of Europe, the hysteria about women is reaching high point and we're going to start having major witch trials and things like that. So anyway, she buggers off. And then the Lord of Howth had to make his way over there and beg for forgiveness. I'm so sorry. He said, what can I do? And she said, always lay a place for me at table. Always lay a place for a guest. So apparently in the great castle at Howth, whenever they have dinner, there's always an extra place laid just in case she turns up.
I'm never getting a decent kind of answer. Did this happen? Is it true?
There's no evidence it actually happened.
I'm just thinking, was there like a tourist board member in the 1940s? Or somebody rocked over to Howth Castle and said, we need to increase our numbers. Give me something. We're close to the sea.
Can we talk about her second marriage, Richard Burke? And were you telling me, Kate, that her previous husband had killed his brother?
There's an EastEnders kind of tangent here, Gillian. You can clear it up for us. Somebody killed somebody's brother.
I think Donal kills Richard's stepbrother.
Stepbrother. Okay.
Yes. But that's pretty standard.
That's not, that's the norm for Gaelic
that's
life.
That's just, yeah.
Swings and roundabouts.
Yeah, there's so many people, so much politicking that, you know.
Sooner or later, somebody's stepbrother gets killed.
Someone got killed. Yeah. Sorry, carry
on. But this second marriage, is this also a marriage of equals?
Yeah, most likely. Okay. I mean, but he was her overlord, Richard Burke, known as Iron Richard or Iron Dick, which is obviously the best name ever. She had a son by him called Theobald, who's known as Tibbet na Long.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's the mid-1560s.
The white-haired boy.
He's the white-haired boy, okay. And he's the great hope. She married Richard Burke at a time when it must have been very evident that English encroachment was on its way.
Okay.
Because you've got the 1550s and 60s, you've got plantations, they know it's coming. So it makes absolute sense to ally yourself with a powerful regional lord, which is what Richard Burke was. So they get married and then they have a baby to seal the deal. In the story about it, she's lying on the ship. She's given birth to the baby. The ship is attacked by Algerian pirates. She delivers the baby, gets the baby out, stands up, gets a couple of pistols and comes out shooting, going, take this load from my unconsecrated hands at the top of her voice. There's loads of folklore about her.
That sounds a little bit Hollywood for me.
They're making a film about her, so I mean, I imagine that's
going to
go
Wonder
in.
Woman.
Would have worked in Game of Thrones is not the same thing as actually happened in history.
No,
sadly.
No, definitely not, no.
Although I have to say, her use of dragons, that's entirely historically accurate.
She's out and about causing trouble with her ships and all the rest of it. And she gets arrested by, I think it's the Earl of Desmond in the 1570s. And she gets thrown into Dublin Castle for a while in prison there and gets out. Anyway, it's a time of kind of massive unrest in the country. There's the Desmond rebellion.
When she gets out, does she negotiate her way out? Does she escape?
She got let out eventually. Okay. So anyway, she comes out and around that time, look, there's lots of unrest in the country. There's lots of Gaelic and older English lords turning against the Tudors. She starts to work with her husband. He wants to be the next MacWilliam, who's the chief there. So she works with him to attain that. They succeed in it. About 1580, he's declared MacWilliam. It's more or less surrendering or granted a version of it. So they give him his title under English law.
It's basically, give us up your land and we'll give them right back to you,
but now
you're accepting that we're your overlords.
Absolutely. So she's then an English lady and an Irish quasi-Gaelic chieftain because through some mechanism, she's still involved, it seems, in the O'Malley lordship. And we know this because when she went to England in the 1590s, she speaks on behalf of her countrymen, meaning the O'Malleys. Mm. So she definitely has influence there.
What's the first record of her that we can sort of stand over and go, this event definitely happened?
Okay, so the interesting thing about Gráinne O'Malley is she's this great icon of Gaelic womanhood and has emerged as that. And there's basically nothing about her in Gaelic sources. It's like she didn't exist.
Wow.
Where you find the information on her is in English sources. Mm-hmm. Henry Sidney writes about her in 1577. So she starts emerging quite late on. And there's record which she herself responded to, 18 articles of interrogation, a kind of thing, which the English government gave to her, which she answered, and which she talks about her life and how she got to the point she was and addresses the piracy stuff and things like that. So the real chunky bits about her come quite late.
Okay.
Yeah, when she starts to get caught up in the English moves towards planting and, as they saw it, civilising Connacht. So as the English growing imperium begins to impinge on her life, that's when she really starts to appear in the records.
I was about to say, we're going to have to introduce these interesting characters that punctuated Gráinne Óil's life. And the first one would be Sir Humphrey Gilbert. And then the other one is Sir Henry Sidney. So give us a pen portrait, Gillian, of these two lovely chaps.
Well, Humphrey Gilbert is a psychopath. The machine, the military machine, ramps up substantially in the latter half of the 16th century. So you do have men like Humphrey Gilbert carrying out massacres. I talk about him at one stage taking a break from mass murder. So you have these career military officers and career kind of diplomats coming into Ireland, like Henry Sidney, like Humphrey Gilbert. There's a whole raft of them when they're back home in England. They are the most urbane, civilised, remarkably well-educated, Renaissance ideals. And then they come to Ireland, certainly Gilbert, and they behave monstrously and they are determined to impose the imperial project on Ireland.
Diplomat and psychopath is not a well-known combination.
Oh, they are. Some of them are absolutely remarkable in how they disport themselves. I mean, there's lots of letters home from people like Gilbert talking about just slaughtering people, just men, women and children. So they'll talk about literally just wiping everyone out. It begins to be total war.
How subversive to that English order is the fact that you have someone like Grace O'Malley off the west coast of Ireland essentially charging taxes and fishing fees to anybody who wants to travel through? I mean, does that undermine the tax raising power of London or wherever?
Yeah, absolutely. To have these local lords who do as they please, basically with their own private armies, is not what the British project was about in the early 16th century. They are all about order and imposing civility because they believe, of course, it will raise revenues. They will be able to raise revenues easily. And Ireland has always been a drain on English revenues. It's always the problem. And the big thing that kicks everything off then is Richard dies, I think, around 1583. And then the man of the moment arrives in Connacht, and that's Richard Bingham. I think he arrives in 1584. He's a man who said, the Irish have only been tamed by swords, not by words. And he went to town on her. He absolutely pulled all his efforts towards wiping her out
and we know ending that. Her influence. We know that he is borderline obsessed with her.
Yes, he is. Yeah.
And is it because she's a woman or is it because she's just not toned the line, I wonder?
Part of the reason Bingham hated her was because the O'Malleys were really good at bringing in Gallowglass from Scotland.
Yes,
okay,
of course.
So the Gallowglass are these professional, excellent soldiers that the Gaelic lords would bring in during the campaigning season to fight for them. The O'Malleys are really good at it and they do it all the time. So that's really pissing him off.
Okay.
And looking at that conflict between Richard Bingham, who is governor of Connacht at this point, given the gender views at the time, is it even more humiliating for him, the idea that there is a chieftain run by an Irish woman who is thumbing her nose at him or is asserting her authority? If it gets back in London that he can't even control the women in the part of territory he's meant to be governing, well, Jesus, you know, how good are you as an imperial official? Is there some sense of that, perhaps?
I think, yeah. I think misogyny plays a very big part in how she's viewed and how she's treated. He's from that same background that would have viewed disorderly women as absolutely reprehensible. I mean, disorderly women are being burnt as witches in the rest of Europe. So he would not have had any time for that.
And yet he is serving Queen Elizabeth I.
Well, there's the great issue, isn't it? There's the great disjoint because there's a woman head of state for the first time ever.
So in the few minutes we've left, can we come to what is, I think, a lot of people's one reference point for Grace O'Malley, Gráinne Whale, her meeting with Elizabeth I. We don't know if that actually happened.
No, we have it from a later source. I think it's been found in an 18th century source. There is nothing at the time, which is unusual, OK, because there are records from that trip she took in 1593 to plead with Elizabeth I.
And this is about her son.
Yeah. So by about 1591, Bingham, 1592, Bingham had completely worn her down. He occupied her land. He'd burnt her ships. She was completely in bits. He also, his brother, John, killed Gráinne's son, Owen, who was an O'Flaherty son. And it was awful. They tied him up and they stabbed him. And they said he got injured trying to escape. Yeah, sure. OK. But at the same time, right, O'Donnell was coming down into O'Malley lands and raiding her. So Grace knew.
All fronts.
She was under siege on all fronts. Yeah. And she sent a letter to Elizabeth. And then Bingham took Tibbet. He arrested Tibbet because the O'Neills were causing trouble in Ulster. He suspected Theobald of being involved and he arrested him, and she absolutely panicked and set sail for London to talk to the Queen herself, as she put it. She went over there. She would have had dealings with William Cecil, Lord Burghley, and he gave her this kind of questionnaire, which we still have today.
So these would have been...
She filled it in.
Okay, so she'd have petitioned. There would have been lots of other petitioners.
Loads
this would
of
have
them.
Been where Greenwich Palace, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, they would have visited there. So there was always loads of Gaelic Irish over there as well. So the story is that while she was there, she met Elizabeth I and she had a runny nose or something and someone gave her a handkerchief, I think it was, to blow into and then looked for it back and she said, that's a disgusting habit, we don't do that. And that she spoke to Elizabeth in Latin because neither of them spoke English or Irish, you know, they couldn't do that. And that it was this meeting of women. Look, it likely didn't happen, right? But the interesting story is it's about an Irish person being civil in a place where Irishness was derided as barbarity, especially at that stage. It's about putting a kind of a foot down and go, no, no, we are civil. We are cultured. We have this ancient culture and language. And it's about two women, two really powerful women. I mean, she's by no means as powerful as Elizabeth I.
Yeah.
She's portrayed as sort of as that in the Irish imagination.
And two older women at this time.
Two older women. They're in their 60s. Now, so it probably didn't happen, right? But it's a wonderful image. But also, we know Elizabeth was interested in her. Elizabeth basically forgave her and sent her back and gave her son's title to land. So Elizabeth was interested and sympathetic. And what Elizabeth didn't do, brilliantly, is ask her for any guarantees on her behaviour. So she just went back and kind of took up where she left off again. And Bingham eventually was sent packing and died in absolute disgrace.
Okay.
And at the end of it all, towards the end of her life, Grace was dying. We think she died. There's a mention of her in 1601 and then never again. She left her son, Theobald, in prime position to continue under the Tudor regime. she recognised this was the new realism. This is the new normal. This Tudor regime is what's going.
And he was
a total pragmatist. They fought on the English side in the 9 Years' War.
Yeah, he's Viscount Mayo, isn't he?
And he becomes Viscount Mayo in something like 1627, biggest landowner in Mayo's. She does the ideal thing that a medieval early modern ruler or lord does. She leaves her descendants set up for life. You couldn't ask for better than that. She did exactly the right thing according to her mindset.
It's the century of Machiavelli, right? And the prince. So maybe news travelled fast from Italy that the ends justify.
Well, yeah.
It sounds almost like she's a latter-day Dermot McMurdo, you know, the chieftain who invites the Normans in. And yes, she's attracted none of the infamy or little of the infamy that he does. You know, she's not seen as a traitor to the culture. She's kind of celebrated now. I'm interested in the way that she's been remembered by different generations and how the memory of her has shifted over time.
So in the 19th century, she's seen as a sellout. She's seen as a terrible woman, because she betrayed her own for the English, because there's a lack of understanding, of course, at the time of the complexity of what was actually happening. She's in Finnegan's Wake. She's Gráinne Malice. She's seen as a brilliant rebel now. She's in those good night stories of rebel girls, that kind of stuff. She changes, as Irish people view, how they change the complexity of their history. Nowadays, for people like me, she was a woman, first and foremost, in a man's world, which made her life immeasurably difficult on many fronts. To get to where she did is almost unimaginable. So she made the practical, hard-headed decisions she had to make based on what was best for her and her family at the time. I mean, I've had people on Twitter now tell me she was a sellout and a traitor. I mean, what? But for me,
that's just Twitter though, isn't it?
I mean, that's just bonkers. It's like, what century are you in, sir? Her gender doesn't dictate everything, but her gender is a massive part of it. She occupied a position no one ever had before. She's remarkable in many. She must have had an unbelievable amount of opposition all the time. She navigated that. She navigated opposition, navigated death threats from a new English regime, and managed to come out on top when so many Gaelic leaders didn't. All you have to think about is the flight of the earls to find out what happened to the rest of them. She's iconic because she's the most extreme flowering of female power that we have in Gaelic Ireland. And then it goes.
And then it ends.
And it's replaced by something very different. So the old accommodations between Gaelic Irish and English Irish, that all goes. That's going now. That's never going to come back as it was before.
Well, we couldn't have asked for a better illustration of just how thorny and complex Ireland's relationship with the British Empire really is. So huge thank you to our guest today, Gillian Kenny. Do keep an eye out for her forthcoming book on Grace O'Malley.
Also, thanks to all of those who are responsible for helping us get the series on the air, to Jack Murphy, Elizabeth Larrigy, Nigel Wheatley and Sally Curran. And also our theme music is from composer Bill Whelan's Belfast Linen and Lace.
If you want to listen back to any of our previous episodes, you can find them wherever you podcast. Just search Irish Imperial Lives. And thanks for listening.